You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. Nobody needs to die in natural disasters. According to a new book, there is a science of prediction and risk management that can warn, prepare, and save millions of lives in the future. So why isn't it being applied now? We've reached an expert's expert as Chief Research Officer for the company RMS Risk Management Solutions. Robert Muir Wood tracks global disasters. He travels into the crumbled or drowned chaos afterwards and models the risk. Robert Muir Wood was a lead author of the 2007 Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change Report and the 2011 IPCC Special Report on Extremes. Governments, insurance companies, and investors listen to him. Now we're going to listen, and I expect we'll hear strategies that haven't yet made it through the mainstream media. We'll talk to Robert Muir Wood about his latest book, The Cure for Catastrophe: How We Can Stop Manufacturing Natural Disasters. Robert, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hello.
Well, hi. Why don't we start at the ground level and work up? Why does the media fascination with epicenters mislead people about the real nature of earthquakes?
Okay, well, this is a detail, one could say, but it's a curious feature of history that a big earthquake is caused by the breakage of a very, very large fault. A fault is simply a discontinuity, a planar feature in the outer shell of the Earth. And the bigger the earthquake, the bigger the fault that breaks to cause it. And it's now possible to get seismologists to actually tell you the overall pattern, the overall geography of the fault that breaks to cause a big earthquake. I mean, when I say a big earthquake like the earthquake off Japan in 2011, that was a magnitude 9 earthquake. It was formed by a fault that was perhaps 500 kilometers long. But the media still ask seismologists to tell them where the epicenter is. And the epicenter is simply the point where that fault started to break. And that where the fault starts to break could be at one end or the other. It sometimes is in the middle, but it's not giving you a good picture of the totality of the fault that breaks. So it's a misleading element of how we communicate around earthquakes.
Well, we are at the detail level, and we will build up to the big picture, but I did notice that in an online video, you said Californians have completely underestimated the strength and number of possible earthquakes. Can you tell us about that?
Well, the situation in California, I mean, I think that there is appreciation that this is earthquake country. There's a plate boundary running through the state, but it's been quite a while now since there was a significant earthquake in the state. I mean, we have to go back to 1994 on the Northridge earthquake north of Los Angeles. Since that time, we've been in this extraordinary quiet period, and actually more and more people have moved to California in the past two decades who have had no experience of what a big earthquake is like. And sooner or later, somewhere, either in northern or southern California, there's going to be a big earthquake, a big high magnitude 6, low magnitude 7 size earthquake, and it's going to have very significant consequences, because while there is a very good building code today, there's a lot of legacy buildings which were built before that code, and we know a lot of those are not going to do so well. We can identify which those buildings are, but and we can try and retrofit some of them, but actually we can't get on top of the totality of the whole problem of what is going to happen in the next big earthquake there.
And the actual insurance in that region has dropped for earthquakes.
Yes, I mean, for homeowners, it's down to about 10% now, which is not good. It means that a lot of people, the day after the earthquake, are going to wake up to the fact that their house may be worth less than the value of the mortgage they have on it, and they may be tempted to hand it back to the bank at that point, and that'll have a cascade of consequences on the economy. We can see it's, although on some level there's very good science in California of understanding earthquakes, of the earthquake engineering too, it's actually not fully connected with how people the disaster culture in California is not anticipating what this is going to be like to a sufficient degree.
Well, good. Robert Muirwood, you've said risk management is a task of imagination. How did imagination fail in the great Japanese tsunami of 2011?
Well, as I say, it's a failure of the imagination. One feature of as we try and understand catastrophe risk is we need to have some understanding of how big a particular event can be. I mean, that could be how intense a hurricane could be, how deep a flood could be, or for earthquakes, just how big the magnitude of the earthquake could be, because how big the magnitude also tells us how big the tsunami that an earthquake can generate if it happens under the sea in a nearshore environment. And in Japan, in the build-up to 2011, the Japanese nuclear industry had sited 14 nuclear power plants along the Pacific coast of Japan precisely because they were assured that actually it didn't suffer the largest of all earthquakes, that they simply hadn't happened there. But in fact, some geologists and historians had discovered that there had already been a giant earthquake on this margin in the 800s, so more than 1,100 years ago, and there was increasing evidence of how big it actually had been. They took this evidence to the nuclear industry in about 2008 and 2009, but they couldn't really get people to take it seriously. And then the earthquake happened in 2011, which was pretty much a repeat of the event which had happened 1,100 years before. It was accompanied by a massive tsunami, bigger than the tsunami protection walls on the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plants. And as we know, as a result, three of them suffered meltdown. And it was all highly avoidable if they had moved the generators higher up in the stations, which is estimated, if it would have only cost $10,000 or something, they could have actually ensured there was a power supply to keep the circulation in those reactors going even after the tsunami had hit.
You know, when I lived in Vancouver, Canada, my children went to a very old brick school, and that city always knows the big one is coming, but it never seems to have the budget to make schools safe. If that happens in one of the wealthy cities of the world, what hope do kids have in northern Turkey, Chile, or any other earthquake zone?
Well, absolutely. I mean, it was a great innovation that came out of California after an earthquake in 1933 in Long Beach, where the earthquake had happened an hour after schools had closed for the day, and somebody estimated that up to 5,000 children could have died if the earthquake had occurred an hour earlier. And it actually prompted some very rapid action in California to ensure that actually schools were inspected, that first of all new schools and then old schools had to be brought up to standards so they didn't fall down in earthquakes. I mean, in California it was very successful, but they weren't able to export it effectively to other states and other countries in the way they should. And I'm not sure of the situation in Vancouver today, but I mean, there should absolutely be an inspection procedure for schools. We know what it takes. We know it doesn't cost that much, and it can really save hundreds or thousands of lives.
Very important lives. Let's move on to coastal flooding. It could be a high storm surge or a tsunami from a faraway quake. Robert Muirwood, if you had to list the top three most flood-endangered cities in the world, what would they be?
The most flood-endangered cities? There are coastlines which are very prone to storm surge flooding. I might include the city of Tampa Bay in Florida, simply because, I mean, it has not experienced a big storm surge. It has a coastline which actually makes it prone to big storm surges. It requires a particular track of a hurricane to do that, but that hurricane hasn't actually happened for more than 100 years, but one day there will be a big storm surge into the city. In Bangladesh, we know we get very, very big storm surges from typhoons, cyclones actually coming into the Bay of Bengal, and they are a huge problem. They have built many evacuation centers now made out of concrete on stilts to give people somewhere to go, but that remains extremely flood-prone. I mean, another city which concerns me, again, is simply on my list because it probably doesn't appreciate the risk, is the city of Bangkok in Thailand, which knows it has a big river flooding problem, but also there's the possibility of getting a tropical cyclone tracking into the north of the Gulf of Siam and actually pushing a storm surge in front of it, in which case the city is only just above sea level and the whole city would be flooded as a result.
They did have some flooding a couple of years ago. I can't remember the exact cause, but I remember them. The factories were flooded and so on.
Yeah, they had flooding in 2011, in the fall of 2011 in Thailand. And the subtitle of my book is How We Can Stop Manufacturing Natural Disasters. And this was a classic case of a manufactured natural disaster in that the government had wanted to turbocharge the economy and by getting a lot of manufacturers who needed components from each other, for example, in the car-making business, to actually sit on the same industrial site. And in order to make this policy work, which they established in the 1990s, they needed very large areas of flat land, which was previously undeveloped and cheap, and on which to build these industrial estates. And I mean, that is another definition of a floodplain. So they used the floodplain, which had not previously been built on, of the Chao Phraya River to the north of Bangkok, and developed these vast industrial estates. And then, you know, you could not be surprised when a few years later they all flooded and remained flooded for 4 to 6 weeks, causing significant disruption to a number of technologies around the world, including hard drive and auto manufacturing.
That's why I remember it. My hard drive was threatened. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is Dr. Robert Muir Wood. He's traveled the world investigating and lecturing on the biggest disasters. In September, he released his new book, The Cure for Catastrophe, How We Can Stop Manufacturing Natural Disasters. Well, Robert, as you know, Category 3 Hurricane Nicole recently blew through Bermuda, their second in October this year. What did the government of the Bahamas do that actually increased individual preparedness for storms?
The government of the Bahamas, in terms of actually what it has done around preparedness, I mean, certainly the Bahamas knows that it's absolutely in the front line of storms, and that everybody appreciates it. Much of it is very low-lying, so people appreciate they also have a storm surge as well as a wind hazard problem there. I mean, one story from Bahamas I tell as a sort of example of tough love is that, unlike the situation in the U.S., the government is not involved in providing a backstop if insurance isn't available, and there's a what's called a canal estate, so a very, very low-lying estate of houses on the island of Grand Bahama, which is only just above sea level, and which has been flooded in storm surges so often that you can no longer get insurance there. But actually, that's encouraged some owners to start building their houses on concrete stilts, and actually then by that means they bring them back into being insurable again. So there's a little parable about one way in which adaptation to climate change may actually work is that if the government is not involved, people will take their own action in order to increase their resilience.
There's a beautiful story in your book where during the 2004 mega flood of Thailand, the Japanese professor Toshitaka Katada devised a three-line instruction for children. It was like a tsunami haiku, I think, but I hear a value for all kinds of preparedness. I'd like to read those three lines, Robert, and then get your comment on each of them. It reads, "Don't believe in preconceived ideas. Do everything you can. Take the lead in evacuation." There's a lot packed in there. Why are these memorable steps so necessary?
Well, they're memorable steps in part because they were very successful, in that to this professor who had seen the way in which people had waited for official instruction after the great earthquake followed by a tsunami in the Indian Ocean in 2004. He'd seen from that actually he'd seen what hadn't worked, and so he came back to Japan, and he then promoted in schools in a single city his ideas for how they should distrust official information, how they should take the lead. And then two or three years after he'd given the lessons, the great earthquake happened off the coast of Japan, followed by a tsunami, and the students in the schools in the city actually really did, or enough of them followed his precepts. They didn't trust the official instruction, which was that a number of these towns had tsunami walls, and the tsunami walls weren't in fact high enough, and so they were quite right not to trust them. And they took their lead in actually running up the hill. They didn't wait for the teachers to tell them what to do, and all the other children started following them. And in fact, every child who was at school that day in this city survived, and even while more than 1,000 people in this particular city died. So This was very, very successful advice. You can't just assume that official instruction is going to have completely anticipated what is happening.
Definitely, and I think the people in New Orleans couldn't wait for the government to tell them what to do because it just didn't come.
That's correct, yeah.
So you've been in the inner circles of scientists and other experts on the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Yet it seems to me you've been wary of including climate risks in your portfolio, and you complained Lord Stern misused your research. Robert, are you cautious about the risks of climate change?
I take a scientific view of it, which is, I'm always a little worried when people jump to think about the risks of climate change before, first of all, thinking about the risks of the current state of the climate, because it's not that, we have a set of extreme events already, and then there's the question how they're changing. And there clearly is evidence that some of them are changing and will change even further into the future. But I'm a little cautious at simply labeling events climate change when we know that, I discuss in the book quite a lot about all the work that goes on in what is called attribution studies today, which is to run the Earth's climate with and without the increase in greenhouse gases back to 1950 and see what is the difference between a world which we have increased greenhouse gases and one which hadn't. In terms of if you run a climate model and you see how often you get particular events, for example, big floods in a particular part of the world, well, the original work in this area was done in big floods happening in the UK in at this time of year, and see how what is the difference in the number of times that happens between these two worlds, between a climate change world and a non-climate change world. And that does actually tell you how the probability of some event has changed. And I think that is very, very helpful, actually getting this balance of making sure we don't get accused of mislabeling things when we don't have the evidence to identify the climate change signature, which we know is there in sea level rise, in more intense rainfall events, and, for example, in a longer wildfire season.
Another of my concerns is that a series of natural disasters close enough together could bankrupt major insurance companies, and with them, perhaps the banks, pension funds, and investors tied there. Could the system go broke?
It's very unlikely. I mean, it certainly could have gone broke, and it almost went broke about 25 years ago. But actually, I work in the area of risk modeling, and these risk models are now sort of very extensively used for how the insurance world does business around risk. And there's always some remote potential for a sequence of events to happen in some way, in an unusual way. But we can really calculate the probabilities of that. And actually, from everything I've seen, the industry is pretty robust these days. I mean, one feature, if we compare the banking sector and the insurance sector, and the banking sector had its crisis in 2007, 2008, where it discovered that the risk models they were using really were not at all reliable because they didn't capture human herd behavior. And actually, we find if we're modeling earthquakes or hurricanes, actually the physics of the Earth is a lot more stable than actually than the contagion of human behavior that we may see in how markets behave in the banking sector.
Now, your book offers a cure for catastrophe, and that's a big idea, but please take as long as you like to give us some ideas of what should be done.
Okay. Well, I use the term the cure to catastrophe. I mean, I leave it ambiguous as to whether, is there a cure? Is there a simple cure? Is this like a slogan? Is it a hope? There is much we can do. There's much which has been done, which helps us anticipate and prepare for catastrophes. I mean, the first component is simply education. Is actually, we have a lot of good scientific knowledge of where catastrophes have the potential to occur now. Now, we're still sometimes surprised, but actually 9 times out of 10 or 19 times out of 20, we're not so surprised. The events that happened, we had really anticipated. So we can't simply blame the fact that this was surprising in some way, and in which case then we can plan and prepare for what is likely to happen. I mean, we know a range of earthquakes which can happen around San Francisco. We know the range of hurricanes that could impact different Caribbean islands. We have this information, and we should be focused on taking the action to ensure that, you know, the buildings are able to withstand that particular level of ground shaking or wind speed or flooding, and that people are prepared, that they are informed. The culture of disasters is sufficient to let them know that they are at risk and tell them what they need to do. And we can move to a situation. I mean, I mentioned a couple of places. I mentioned Holland around its treatment of flood risk. I mean, it really has got on top of it. It's owned by everyone. It's not just done by technocrats. It's sort of owned by the population. I think that Chile in earthquakes is getting closer and closer to the day when you can have a big earthquake and actually the casualties will be measured in tens of people rather than hundreds or thousands. So we can point at examples where countries or cultures are really getting on top of being able to ride out these events when they happen. And, you know, and it's not too far-fetched for there to be situations where we have a really big hurricane, a really big earthquake, and actually the consequences are fairly minimal. I mean, that won't be everywhere, but some places are moving towards that goal.
Well, we won't have time to cover much about volcanoes, which is in your book, but there haven't been many in the news lately. But that's another mistake, isn't it?
It's for volcanoes. I describe the great challenge of volcanoes. Big eruptions are rare. I mean, at a single volcano, big eruptions may happen hundreds of years apart, so that everybody who's given the job of managing the information around a volcanic eruption is likely to be a complete novice. I mean, it's likely to be the first time they have done it. And actually, the politicians will be watching this person intently, because there are many, many ways in which they can get it wrong. I mean, they can either get people to evacuate too early or too late, and they can get people to evacuate too near the volcano, and the volcanic eruption can be bigger than they anticipated, and they can get people to evacuate for too long, and so the economy can't start getting going again. So it's a huge challenge, the responsibility of being, if you like, the volcano eruption manager. And actually, we have not got a solution to that. I mean, it would be almost better if there was an international agency which was able to move in and provide this capability, but then that would be a problem with local politicians. So, yeah, I mean, we haven't seen a big eruption near a city since 1991 or something in Mount Pinatubo in the Philippines, and you know, sooner or later there will be another such threatening volcano, and the question is, are we prepared?
Well, we did run out of time before we got to fires, and that's ironic because half the countryside around me burned down last year. We had fire refugees arrive in our tiny village with absolutely nothing, so I'm personally familiar with that risk. Listeners, I've had time to read Robert Muir Wood's new book, The Cure for Catastrophe, How We Can Stop Manufacturing Natural Disasters. It wasn't a chore because this stuff fascinates me, and Robert does a great job of keeping us there in the scene while we learn from him. He's the Chief Research Officer for RMS Risk Management Solutions. He has a PhD in Earth Sciences from Cambridge University. He's been a lead author in two important reports by the IPCC, the author of 6 books, published over 150 scientific papers. He advises on high levels of business and government on large-scale disasters. I'll put links to Robert, his book, and some videos in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. Check it out. Robert, thank you so much for sharing your time with us. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening to Radio EcoShock, and thank you for caring about our world.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.